We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge and we're very glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about memory. Now, we like to think that, at least most of us like to think that our memories are good and that the pictures of the past that we carry around in our head are accurate. But in fact, psychological research tells us that memory is notoriously unreliable and in some predictable ways. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Daniel Schachter. He's professor of psychology at Harvard University, and he is a researcher who has done a lot of work on memory and also has written a lot on the subject. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk. This is the Lyle Lanier Lecture. It's a series that's named for Lyle Lanier, who was at one time the head of the Department of Psychology here at the U of I. This talk will take place today, this evening, at the Spurlock Museum in the Knight Auditorium, and he'll be talking about future memory, imagining, remembering, and the brain. This is an event that's open to anybody who would like to attend. It's certainly free and open. So if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana and you'd like to hear from him, you can stop by. Also, if you're interested in reading about memory, you might take a look at his book, The Seven Sins of Memory, which came out in 2001 and is a book that's for the general reader who is interested in learning more about memory and how it works and what science has to say about that. So you can go out and look for that book. And of course, here on the program, if you'd like to call in and ask a question, you can do that. We hope people will be on the topic. We'll try to be brief so we can get as many as possible in the show. But people can call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And you may also send us email, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Good morning.
Just to begin, I guess the point to make is that I think people have this idea that that our memory is a one way or another, it's a kind of a recording device. And their image of the memory might be a big vault in which I was going to say videotapes. Maybe that dates me. Maybe now DVDs. I don't know. These things are stored. And when we remember something, what we're doing is we're going to the shelf, pulling it off, and then replaying it. Well, that's not the way that memory works at all, is it?
It's not. It's a very, very common metaphor. And I think it's one that is widely accepted, certainly among many, many non-memory researchers, but memory researchers are skeptical of that kind of view, largely because of many, many experiments now that have been done over a period of years and decades that have shown that memory is prone to certain kinds of errors and distortions that would pretty much rule out the possibility that what we're doing is replaying a tape. Because if we really had just a photograph or a tape stored away, it's unlikely that we would make some of the mistakes that we do. And those mistakes, to many of us who study memory, are what make it really interesting. Mm-hmm. And they suggest the need to come up with some kind of alternative model of memory rather than that of a video camera, photograph, etc.
And this is It, as I understand it, sort of an ongoing research project, because even now, with as much as we have learned, it's still something of an unanswered question. How exactly does memory work?
Yeah, it is still pretty much of an unanswered question. And there are many levels at which it can be approached. So psychologists have just looked at primarily have looked at memory by administering cognitive tests, mm-hmm. presenting materials to people, asking them to remember those materials after some period of time has passed, or in some cases asking them about their memories of their everyday lives. But we also want to know what the brain contributes to memory. And for a long time, that was something that was approached in memory research primarily by studying experimental animals, because we making lesions in different parts of the brain and seeing what kinds of memory what kinds of memory functions were impaired, and to some extent by studying patients with brain damage who have damage in parts of the brain that produce memory problems without producing other kinds of problems. More recently, the field has advanced because of the availability of new neuroimaging or brain scanning techniques that allow us to look inside the brain as people are encoding, retrieving information, and that's providing a new window on what we can learn about memory in the brain. So a lot of us are excited now that we're getting closer to an answer to your question, though we still have a long way to go.
Well, one, I'm sure that when people think about the brain, or at least the way that people have thought about the brain in the past, must have been this idea that there are particular places of the brain that do particular things. So there's one place that's all about language, and there's another place that's maybe has to do with physical coordination, and then there's another place that has to do with the ability to appreciate and to do something artistic, and there's another place where your math brain is stored, and these different areas that do specific things. Is it the case, though, that with what we're seeing, and probably happens in a lot of areas, but what we're seeing is memory, is that there are, depending on what it is you're doing, different parts of the brain may be working. So it's not just the case that one spot is just all about memory.
Right. It's rarely the case in memory or even in other aspects of cognition that there would be just one spot that is rigidly tied with doing only doing the entire task or the entire domain of memory. We would tie to one spot, so sort of the naive kind of localization view you're talking about probably dates all the way back to the old days of phrenology, when there was this part of the brain that was tied up with will, or this part of the brain was tied up with social functions. Now, there are elements of truth to that. There certainly is a case for localization of function still, in which different parts of the brain contribute specific functions to particular tasks. But I think as our understanding has evolved, what we've seen is that individual parts of the brain are really operating as part of larger networks. And what we're trying to understand in memory and in other aspects of cognition is what particular brain regions contribute to broader networks that are critical for carrying out the various memory or other functions that we're interested in.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Daniel Schachter. He's professor of psychology at Harvard University and is a researcher that works in the area of memory. And he's here visiting the campus. We'll give a talk this evening, and we'll tell you more about that again later on. And questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We also have the email, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, given the fact that we don't yet have a complete understanding of memory works. If we say that it's not a kind of a recording device, that with the metaphor that we talked about before, if we say it's not that, what do we think that it is? How do we think that it works?
Well, that's really the key question. I guess the general phrase at a very general level that I like to use and other people like to use is that we like to think of memory as a constructive process, where constructive means that when we're remembering a past event, now we're not making up, for the most part, we're not making things up out of whole cloth. There is stored information in the brain that we're using and bringing to bear on the task at hand when we're remembering, but what we're doing is kind of integrating or reintegrating bits of information that are stored in different parts of the brain and bringing them all together, constructing a memory out of those stored bits of information that usually corresponds at least roughly to what has happened in the past. But because that act of retrieval is constructive It's not just simply a playback. We are prone to making certain kinds of mistakes. For example, we may jumble up different elements from different events and construct what we think is an accurate memory of the past when, in fact, we've maybe interchanged parts of events. And these kinds of errors can have very important implications in everyday life. Let me give you just one kind of dramatic example of what I'm talking about that comes from actually a memory researcher by the name of Donald Thompson, who was trained at the University of Toronto working under Endel Tulving, a leading memory researcher, where I got my own PhD a few years later. Thompson got his PhD, went back to his native Australia, where he continued working on memory and did some work on memory and the law. You could then imagine how stunned he was one day when he was accused of raping a woman who had, in fact, been brutally raped on the basis of her memory of what he looked like. And her memory was accurate enough to lead the police to question him. Well, fortunately, he had this airtight alibi. He could not possibly have committed that rape because at the moment that it occurred, he was giving a live television interview about, of all things, memory and memory distortion. So it couldn't have been him. So what happened? Well, what happened was that woman was watching that program when an intruder broke into her house. And in the stress of the rape, she kind of confused her memory, where she took that memory of Thompson off the TV and put it on the face of the rapist. So a couple of elements of this episode were kind of mixed up in a way that made her confident that she was accurately remembering what had happened, when in fact, because she was now reconstructing this episode, not playing back a tape, she had made what could have been a very costly error. Fortunately, he had that airtight alibi, but what if he'd been giving a taped interview and didn't have that alibi? Yeah.
Well, that's certainly a great example of one instance where I think we've come to understand that memory, it should be questioned at least, and that is eyewitness accounts that involve crimes, mm-hmm. where people say, this is what I saw. Or where you have somebody who's witnessed a crime, and then so what you do is you do the lineup and you come in and you put down a bunch of pictures, and the person says, picked one of the individuals out and said, that's that. They would just swear that this person was the person, and that there we had now have cases, and I'm sure that there are many cases where it was established, where certain kinds of evidence, maybe now because we have DNA evidence, for example. Mm-hmm. It shows that the person who was identified as by the victim as the perpetrator could not possibly have been the perpetrator. So then I guess you can understand where if the event was extremely stressful, you know, if you were in a life-threatening event, you can understand where that might get things jumbled up. But I'm sure that there are also cases where people are remembering things that are either neutral or things that are pleasant. You know, you get them to start talking about their childhood, and they will tell you stories about the place that they grew up. They'll tell you about their grandparents' house and what the neighborhood looked like and what it was like when you walked down the street. And they'll tell you stories about, one day I was out with my grandpa and we'd been fishing at this lake that was near his house. And then we walked over to this place where we got ice cream. You know, they could tell you a very elaborate sort of a story. And in those cases where you can actually check the details, maybe you go to this place and you see there's no lake there. There never was. The ice cream stand was never, so that this person obviously has made up this story. And they would just say, I can remember this like it was yesterday, but it never happened.
Right. And there are many reasons why that may be so. For example, in the case of the kind of story that you're talking about, there may be some truth to the event. Some aspects of it may have happened, may have indeed happened. But over a period of time, people may talk about the event in different ways. They may start incorporating information from other events, and eventually that new representation becomes their memory, even though it may be picking up elements of different events and kind of putting them all together into one picture. And you're right about the importance of this in eyewitness testimony. It's not just the isolated example here and there. And indeed, the DNA exoneration evidence on this point is very chilling, actually, because, for example, in the first 130 cases of individuals who were exonerated of crimes they didn't commit on the basis of DNA evidence, approximately 100 of those people were put in jail on the basis of mistaken memory, mistaken eyewitness identification. And there are a lot of reasons why it can happen. In the context of my book from a number of years ago, The Seven Sins of Memory, where I talk about seven different kinds of memory errors, there are two that are particularly relevant here. One I called misattribution, and that's kind of what was going on in the Donald Thompson case, when you remember some aspect of an event correctly, but you misattribute how you picked up that information to the wrong source, maybe the wrong the wrong place. Something happened, but you get the setting wrong, or you get the time wrong. That turns out to be a common contributor to eyewitness misidentifications. Another kind of memory error I've called suggestibility. And this is where misleading information may be suggested to a witness, for example. Perhaps the witness is being questioned by an investigator who has a hunch about what happened and asks them leading questions. And there's a lot of work in psychology dating back to the classic studies of Elizabeth Loftus from over 30 years ago showing that people are prone to incorporating misinformation from suggestions into their memories, and their memories become tainted in a way that is very hard to recover from. So suggestibility can also contribute to these eyewitness misidentifications.
Mm. So has law enforcement heard enough about that so that they're starting to be at least a little bit more skeptical, a little bit more careful with eyewitness testimony?
Yeah, I think so. To a degree, yes. I think there's more general awareness among individuals in the legal system than there used to be about the vulnerabilities of memory. I know myself, for example, just about 2 weeks ago, I gave a talk in Cambridge to a judge's seminar that was on the general topic of neuroscience and the law. And I talked about memory distortion, went through a lot of the evidence. And I think a lot more of that sort of thing is going on. I think we have a long way to go, but I think we are making some progress. Of course, another interesting related question is, how can you tell the difference between a memory that's accurate and a memory that's inaccurate? That becomes very critical in these legal cases, and more generally as a theoretical problem for cognitive psychologists and cognitive neuroscientists. And that's very tricky. We and others have done, for example, over the last 15 years, brain imaging studies where you put people in a scanner and you use experimental paradigms that allow you to look at memory distortions with some degree of experimental control, mm-hmm. Where you know that somebody's remembering an event incorrectly. And we've asked the question, can you tell by looking at brain activity whether they're remembering correctly or incorrectly? And you can to some degree, but not to a degree at this point that would allow such evidence to be useful in court.
So you couldn't do an MRI on somebody and tell whether, in fact, their memory was correct or not.
You can do it in groups of individuals where you're kind of averaging across people and across events, but to say that this one person's memory for this single event is either correct or incorrect on the basis of a brain scan is a bit beyond us at this point.
We have a caller here who's been a patient. Let's talk with him in Wellington on our toll-free line, line 4.
Yes,
hello.
This is kind of interesting because I'm interested kind of in part where you kind of touched on something that in part why I had at least one incident that kind of occurred to me. I've been, I guess, kind of a little stressed out dealing with both my parents and the end stages of their life and the aftermath of that the last few years, and I found that while I normally have a pretty good memory, that it's like been skittering all over. Sometimes I do things multiple times because I don't remember that I did it in the first place, and sometimes I've forgotten to do things till long after it was timely for them to be done, or I've kind of jumbled the idea there of memory a little bit. So I'm interested in kind of what the impacts of stressful situations are on memory, and what are some of the things you can do to kind of ameliorate that.
Okay. Well, certainly stressful situations can have a negative impact on memory, and there are various ways in which they can. Picking up on one of the things that the caller said, kind of, you know, forgetting what you wanted to do, forgetting to do things, is something that can be very can be accentuated under stress, where you're focused not so much on what you want to do at the moment, but you may be, you know, thinking about a worrying situation or something that is not occurring in the moment and kind of draws your attention away from what you're doing. And that can result in the kind of irritating and annoying absent-minded errors that we're all familiar with in everyday life. One of the seven sins of memory that I talk about is absent-mindedness, one particular kind of forgetting. And so in innocent forms, this can result in, you know, where did I put my keys? Where did I leave my glasses? Not because our memory is breaking down in the sense that we can't store and retain new information, but mainly because perhaps because of a stressful situation, you know, at the moment that we put down our glasses or we put down our keys, we're focused on something else. We never really encode the event, and it never really becomes stored in memory to begin with. So for that kind of memory error, really the best thing you can do is try to structure your environment in a way that takes some of the burden off memory and minimizes the likelihood that such things will occur. For example, having certain places where you always put your keys or your glasses, so you're going to find them there. Using external reminders. It could be your cell phone, or it could be just a calendar. Relying on those external reminders when for appointments and the like.
Does that help?
Thank you.
All right. Well, that. I guess having increasingly feeling I'm a victim of the same thing, it leaves me thinking about the one problem that we have, and perhaps it becomes more of a problem, is that as we go through our daily lives, we are surrounded by so much stimulation, so much stuff, so many things that we're having to keep track of. And there's no way that you can keep track of everything. But I think that and I think a lot of psychologists, in fact, there's one researcher here at the university who's done some really interesting work that demonstrates that if you're really focused on one thing, really trying to pay attention to one thing, that then other things in your environment in a very real way become invisible. Mm-hmm. You just don't see them. And I think that it seems that there are more and more demands on us to try to keep track of things. And in spite of, I think, many people claiming that they can multitask, it's something that seems to get harder and harder.
It does. And I think some of the work you're referring to, which I believe is probably the work of Dan Simons here.
Yes, exactly.
Which was done when he was on the same floor with me at Harvard a number of years ago. The now famous Invisible Gorilla.
Yeah,
that was
right.
just done down the hall for me. So I'm certainly well aware of that. And I think that that is part and parcel of this, you know, of the rubric of absent-mindedness, where attention is drawn to something else. It may be, for example, there was a recent study, it's either just come out or just coming out in a journal called Applied Cognitive Psychology, along similar lines, where they did kind of a naturalistic study of students who were walking about on the campus at a university in Washington. And they had set up a clown on a unicycle, like in the center of campus, something that you'd say, oh, who could miss that? And what they found was that students who were using cell phones were dramatically more likely to not, even though they walk right by this unicycling clown, just like the invisible gorilla from Simon's work. They didn't even notice this thing that was, you know, jumping out at them in their environment. And I think that is part and parcel of what we're talking about here.
Just maybe I should, real quick, in case people are saying, what do you mean invisible gorilla? We actually talked about this on the program not long ago. And there is a video on this on the web that people can watch it. Now, if you watch it knowing what you're looking for, you don't understand the effect. But essentially what he did was he constructed a situation where he had a bunch of people. I think as I remember it, some people were wearing black T-shirts and some people were wearing white T-shirts. And they were passing a basketball back and forth. And so he said to his experimental subjects, I want you to watch this very carefully. And he said something like, no, I want you to count the number of times that a person with a white T-shirt has the basketball or you know, something like that. What he's saying is saying very specifically, I want you to concentrate on one aspect here. And then he had somebody in a gorilla suit walk right through this. So the people are passing the basketball back and forth. Person in the gorilla suit walks right in the middle, stops, does this gorilla thing where they pound their chest, looks at the camera, and then walks off. And then afterwards, he said to the people who were counting the passing of the basketball, and did you see anything unusual here? And they said, no. They said, did you see the gorilla? And they say, not everyone, but a number of people in an experiment would say, I didn't see the gorilla. Now, if you know what you're looking for, you watch that and you think, how could anybody possibly not see the person in the gorilla costume walk through? But the fact is that significant numbers of people, they're so intent on what it is that the researcher has told them to look for. They're concentrating so much and they're counting, they're looking at the basketball, that literally they do not see the person in the gorilla costume walk through. And that's the point, that if you're concentrating on something so much, that then other things that will be there in the environment, you just won't see them.
Yeah, and that has implications for memory. So what we're talking about here is really very much at the intersection of perception, attention, and memory. Mm-hmm. And they illustrate, again, the point that our mind is not like a camera just blindly taking in information from the environment that automatically then gets stored away in memory. Because in these cases of the clown riding the unicycle or the invisible gorilla, these events just aren't remembered by people because they're not given enough attention initially to get encoded into the memory system. Now, another place where this sort of thing, this interface between attention and memory, has some interesting implications concerns the use of cell phones during driving, which we all know is potentially a dangerous thing, increases probability of having an accident, and yet, you know, many people, if not most people, continue to use cell phones when they drive. And there's some interesting study showing how in a driving simulator where you can tell what an individual has fixated on, what information is hitting the retina of the eye, when they're using a cell phone, even a hands-free cell phone, they have very reduced memory for events in the environment where the researchers know that information at least was processed to the level of the retina. They fixated on it, but they have no memory for having seen it. And indeed, there's evidence that a couple of brain responses that we know that are very sensitive indicators of encoding of information into memory are reduced greatly when you're using a cell phone in a car, even for information that we know is hitting your retina. So there's a very important lesson there about the relationship between attention and subsequent memory.
We're a little bit past our midpoint. We have another caller I'll get right to. I just would like to introduce again our guest, Daniel Schachter. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard University. He studied and also taught at University of Toronto in Canada and also taught at University of Arizona. His particular area of interest is memory. He is here visiting the campus. We'll talk on the subject future memory, imagining, remembering, and the brain, which takes a look at some interesting questions that have to do with the connection between memory and our ability to think about the future, Some people will say that's sort of surprising. We'll try to talk at least a little bit about that. His talk, this is the Lyle Lanier Lecture, sponsored by the Department of Psychology, and it's tonight at 8 o'clock at the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum. So if you want to stop by there, you should feel welcome. Also, if you're just interested in reading about memory, you might take a look at one of the books that Professor Schachter has written. That's The Seven Sins of Memory, and is published in 2001. We have a caller here to talk with in Lafayette, Indiana. Let's go there. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
First, for David, I'd suggest with a guest with any unusual name to spell it for the listeners.
Okay.
I'm in my 70s and having the usual loss of memory, I suppose. So if you're looking for a name or a word, say, it's just off the edge of your mind. How best to restore it, to struggle with it, or to wait for it to come?
That's a very good question, because those kinds of moments of what I call blocking, and the seven sins of memory. One of the seven sins is called blocking, and there's a whole chapter on this kind of memory error. And it's a very interesting question, because they're kind of arguments both ways. On the one hand, we know that cueing has a powerful effect on memory. So if you're blocking on a name or a word or something that you know is stored in memory, coming up with the right kind of hint, trigger, or cue is something that could instantly reinstate that information. So if you can come up with the right cues, if you can find the right cues, then that's the way to go. However, there's a downside. It's also known that in cases of blocking, if you come up with the wrong cue, something that is similar to the word or name you're looking for but doesn't quite trigger it, that can actually prolong the blocking state. It's called in the research literature the ugly sisters effect, by analogy to Cinderella's ugly sisters. You have ugly sisters which are kind of related to the target that you're coming up with, that can prolong the blocking. So it really just depends on your ability to come up with the right kind of cue. If you find that you are, for example, persistently thinking of something else, that means you're getting trapped by an ugly sisters and you're probably best off just letting it go. On the other hand, if your mind is a total blank, then why not try some cues?
Thank you, sir.
All right. To an Urbana person here then. This would be, I think, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Two things. One, I was listening to a book on CD. It was Malcolm Gladwell's Blink, About the Power of Thinking Without Thinking. And this has more to do with the input to memory processing rather than remembering itself. But I found his book fascinating. Eventually, he gets to, farther down the line, he gets to a section on police and what happens to people whose heart rate goes up to a particular level in their ability to focus and think. And he was saying that it's been shown that at a certain level, what you can focus on narrows down tremendously. And also, if your heart rate is up, how you process things changes. And he was talking about why police have found, for instance, that it's better to have one instead of two people in a patrol car, and why high-speed chases often result in bad aftermath once the chase is stopped. And he went to the Amadou Diallo case and went through the analysis of that. And I'm thinking to myself, when I read in the newspaper about people who want to arm themselves so they can defend themselves, I'm thinking, you know, you can teach yourself how to shoot a gun and how to shoot it accurately, but can you then transfer that memory and your knowledge into dealing with a really stressful situation when your heart rate is up? And I'm thinking, So I'm really concerned about that cognition on people who want to arm themselves. And then the second thing is entirely different subject. I'm thinking about the Bible and the Gospels and how it's been, researchers, biblical scholars really strongly feel that there's evidence that none of these were written anywhere near the time of their purported occurrence, 40 to 70 years later, and not by eyewitnesses. I'm thinking, would I believe that material? It seems to me that even if there are events that actually happened, that they've been modified tremendously. So two things, very different things for you to comment on.
All right. Well, can you comment on any of that?
Well, I'll say a few more words about stress and memory and stressful situations, because that was related to some of the callers' concerns and harks back to what we talked about earlier. There is a very interesting phenomenon in the literature on stress, memory, and crime known as weapon focus, which I think speaks to at least part of the caller's question, in which it's known, for example, that when people are faced with a weapon on the other side of the weapon, not wielding the weapon, that they sometimes have very poor memory for the face of the individual who is wielding that weapon. And there are a lot of very nice studies that show that under high stress, when you're aroused, your heart rate is up, things like that, your attention indeed does tend to narrow, as the caller mentions. And what happens is that in that state of emotional arousal, you do have very good memory for the central object, in this case a gun, but at the expense of what's going on in the periphery. So there's this kind of tunnel vision that translates into a very good memory for the central object, but a very poor memory for what's in the surround. And that turns out to be a pretty general thing. You don't have to have a gun in your face in order for that to happen. Generally, emotional arousal will produce this trade-off between heightened memory for what's in the focus of attention and impaired memory for what's in the surround that you ordinarily would remember quite a bit better.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller. We just have about 10 minutes left, and our guest this morning is Dr. Dan Schachter, spelled S-C-H-A-C-T-E-R. He's a professor at Harvard and a memory researcher, and he's here on campus to talk about some of his work, and people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana can hear what he has to say this evening. Also, I do want to mention again, he's written a very interesting book about memory. It's titled The Seven Sins of Memory. So some of the kinds of things we're talking about here this morning are addressed there. So you might want to take a look at the book, and other questions are welcome too. Something I want to come back to is, again, we've talked a couple of times here about how people have this idea that what memory is a kind of recording device, and that what happens when you're remembering something is you're just playing back a recording of an experience. And what you've said is that it's pretty clear that that's not the way that it works. I guess what I think is interesting here is that it seems to be that, and you talk about memory being a constructive process, that what we're doing when we're remembering something is what we're making up a little story, and we're going into our memory at various places and picking up pieces, bits of information here, there, and everywhere, and then taking that and putting that together to construct some kind of narrative that in some way makes sense. Mm-hmm. Can you talk some more about how that works, and maybe also how that leads us to misremember things?
Well, I think I would agree with everything you just said, and maybe the one element we haven't yet talked about very much that's a big part of that construction process involves our kind of our general knowledge, our beliefs, and our feelings, because a lot of that goes into the memory construction. And this is really first pointed out by one of the great pioneers in memory research, Sir Frederick Bartlett, a British researcher who wrote a very, very important book on memory back in 1932 called Remembering, where he gave people stories to read. They were Native American folk tales. And they were a little bit unusual in the way they unfolded. And then he asked them to recall these stories later on. And what he observed back in the 1932 book, reported in the 1932 book based on his experiments, is almost exactly what you just described. People had bits and pieces of the story, but they were often misremembered, and misremembered in ways that reflected something about the beliefs and the knowledge of the rememberer, because all that is part and parcel of the memory construction. And so, again, linking that up with the seven sins, there's another one of the memory sins that kind of, I think, in very interesting ways relates to this, and that's what I call bias, retrospective bias, which is another way of saying that memory is often skewed by our current knowledge, beliefs, and feelings. And there are a lot of nice experimental examples of this. For example, studies that have looked at memory for one's political attitudes or attitudes towards social questions, you know, like the legalization of marijuana, something like that, in which the researchers have gotten people's views on that at a particular time and then waited a long time, in some cases 10 years, to ask them later, what did you say about this 10 years ago? And the interesting finding there is that people's memories for their prior attitudes and beliefs are typically more closely related to what they believe at the time they're being asked rather than what they actually said at the time. Mm-hmm. And there are other examples of this. For example, in personal relationships, people's estimates, retrospective estimates of how happy they were in their marriage X number of years ago are more related to their current feelings rather than what they actually said X number of years ago. So these are very powerful influences in memory. I think they're occurring all the time, and they're well documented, but in my opinion, still poorly understood. And we need to do a lot more in that that area.
Something that I know that you often talk about. There is a kind of a classic experiment that you can do, just to demonstrate how you can trick people, you can mm-hmm. fool people, and you can give them a list of words mm-hmm. that are all sort of conceptually related.
Correct.
And then you can say to them, now, here's the list of words, and I want you to remember these, memorize this list. And then a little while after, you say, and we're going to test you, a little while after you test them, and you say, was this word on the list? Was this word on the list? Was this word on the list? And very consistently, you can ask people a particular word. You say, was this word on the list? And they'll say, oh, yeah, when it wasn't. But it would have made sense that word would have been on that list because it's tied to those other words. So clearly what people are doing is they have some sort of logical structure that says certain things go together in a certain way, that just makes sense, and that people are using that to construct their memory. And that's another one of those ways that things get in there that really don't. Well, they belong, but they get it. But they're not something that we're remembering.
Right. That's a nice example. That's known in the experimental psychology literature as the Diess-Roediger-McDermott phenomenon, because it's something that was initially discovered by the psychologist Diess many years ago, and then rediscovered by Roediger and McDermott about 15 years ago at Washington University. And so, as you said, you could give people a list of associated words. Like one of the actual lists from that experiment is candy, sour, sugar, bitter, good, taste, tooth, nice, honey, soda, chocolate, heart, cake, eat, pie. So there are 15 words there. You give people those words, and then you say, was taste on the list? And most people will say yes, and they'd be right. And then you say, was point on the list? And most people would say no, and they would be right. And then you say, was sweet on the list? And there may be some people out there in the audience right now who, even despite our discussion, are saying, oh, yeah, sweet was on the list. Well, no, it wasn't. That's the word to which all the other words are related: candy, sour, sugar, bitter. And there are a couple of different ways of thinking what's going on there. But one of them is that what you're actually remembering is kind of the gist of the list. And you're remembering that quite well. You're remembering that, yeah, everything had to do with sweet. The problem is that that specific item was not there. That makes another, I think, an important point that many of these memory errors that we see are not just, you know, foul-ups in the system, mistakes made by Mother Nature, so to speak, in putting together memory. They're kind of adaptive errors in the sense that when you misremember sweet, you're showing that you have a pretty good memory for the general kinds of things that were presented. You just don't remember the exact detail. And that's one good thing about our memory. We don't store all the irrelevant details, nor would we want to. There are some nice examples out there of people who do have kind of memory for just about everything that happened to them, and it turns out to be much more of a curse than a blessing because it gets in the way of seeing the forest for the trees. So a lot of our memory mistakes are actually reflecting strengths of memory, but they also have a downside.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's a great point for those people that say, well, why wouldn't we want to remember everything? Well, if you remembered everything, your memory would be not functional because there would be too much stuff in there that you really don't need to remember.
That's right.
So selectivity in memory is actually an important thing.
Yeah, and that goes back, for example, the points we were making about attention and memory, that memory is so attention-dependent and encoding-dependent, so that the kinds of things we're going to have a good shot at remembering later on are those things that we really thought about, elaborated on, reflected on at the time that they occurred, probably because they were important. Those are the things we have a shot at remembering later on. And the stuff that we don't elaborate on, we don't attend to, goes by the wayside for the most part.
We're coming down to about 5 minutes. I have a couple of emails. I have another caller here. I want to try to at least get a couple of these. Let me ask you about this one, a question I got by email, as I think you probably could deal with it fairly quickly. A listener wants to know, do people who have high IQs tend to overrate their memory more than others, less than others? I suppose that's maybe the question is both how are people at rating their own memory, how good it is? And then is there some relationship between objective measures of intelligence and memory, you know?
Right. Two questions. I don't know the exact answer to the question of how good people are with high IQs at rating their own memory. But in general, we do have some accuracy in rating our memory, but we are prone to a whole raft of interesting kinds of errors in what researchers call meta-memory. We are, under certain circumstances, prone to predicting that we'll remember more or less than we actually do. Sometimes we get it right, and there are interesting reasons why that is the case. In terms of the relationship between intelligence and memory, well, it depends on exactly what kind of memory you're looking at and what kind of tests you use. But in general, yeah, there is a relationship, for example, where for certain kinds of memory tests, IQ is related to tracks memory performance, your ability to hold items in your working memory, the kind of memory you use to keep information alive for a brief period of time is sometimes strongly related to IQ. But we know that those things can be dissociated quite sharply. One of the most interesting kinds of phenomena of memory occurs in certain cases of brain damage, where people have damage to a part of the brain called the hippocampus and some nearby structures in the inner part of the temporal lobe of the brain that are very important for creating new memories. Those individuals, you can have damage to those parts of the brain, and your IQ may remain very high, well above average, and you might be left with almost no ability to store and retrieve new experiences and new information. So those two things, while they are often related in healthy individuals, can be sharply dissociated.
Right. We'll try to get a caller here. Savoy, line one. Hello.
Hi. I understand the idea that memories are often held together by common themes and even things like the Magic Castle. But how do people remember random digits of sequences, like, you know, digits of pi?
Very good question, and the first part of your question may actually supply the answer, that what we know, that people who become very proficient at doing things like remembering digits do so because they're able to convert those digits into meaningful units or chunks. There's a beautiful study conducted in the 1980s on this point, in which they looked at the question of whether you could train up normal people's memory to remember digits immediately. So most of us, if I read out a bunch of digits, can only spit back 7 plus or minus 2 is the number we often use in psychology immediately. And what was found by these researchers is that there was a student they studied who, over a period of training, like anybody else, could only give back 7 plus or minus 2 digits. But as the training proceeded over weeks and months, his memory for those digits grew to an astounding rate, to the point where he could give back 80 digits immediately in correct order for a string that he had never heard. And what it turned out he was doing was he developed a strategy based on converting those numbers to running times. He was a running, he was a track team member at Carnegie Mellon University on the track team, knew a lot about running times, and he converted those digits into meaningful sequences. And so the kind of final point of that study was that when they tested him for letter strings, at the time he could do 80 numbers, he could still only do 7 letters. He hadn't strengthened a memory muscle. He had learned a technique for converting digits into something meaningful. So good memory for seemingly random digit strings probably is just a reflection of someone using encoding strategies that import their prior knowledge into the task.
We're going to have to stop. I'm really sorry that we have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. And the one thing that I thought we might talk about, we didn't, but that's okay, because for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to hear more from our guest, Dr. Daniel Schachter. He'll be talking about future memory, imagining, remembering, and the brain, talking a little bit about how it is that our memory for the past plays a role in our ability to think about the future. And that's tonight at 8 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum. This is the Lyle Lanier Lecture, sponsored by the Psychology Department here at the U of I. And just generally, if you'd like to read more about memory, you might look for Dan Schachter's book, The 7 Sins of Memory. It was first published in 2001. I'm sure you can find it in bookstore in the library, and you'll find it interesting reading. Our guest, Dr. Daniel Schachter, is professor of psychology at Harvard University. Thank you very much for being
here. Thank you. Enjoyed it.